So anyway, my name is Edward Morey. This is Microeconomics, Principles of Micro, Econ 2010, Section 100. If you signed up a while ago, hopefully you got a bunch of emails from me. They're really important emails. If you just recently signed up, I'm going to wait a day or two, probably later today or tomorrow, and I'll resend all those emails. But I can't figure out who's new and who's not new. So if you get an email that looks like something you got last week, it's exactly what you got last week. Right? But if you weren't here last week and you weren't signed up last week, you didn't get the email. So it has to do with the course, web pages for the courses, for the course, when the exams are, all kinds of stuff like that. So important stuff. So we have this whole new technology up here that I've never seen before. So we're going to see if we can make it work. And I'm trying to remember how it works. So if this works, hopefully we're going to be able to change the screen remotely. So microeconomics, think about the word economics, and then in the word economics we have this prefix micro. So there's microeconomics and there's macroeconomics. What is it? Well, what's microeconomics? It's a set of theories or models. In this class, I'm going to use the word models or theories as synonyms. We build models. We build theories. Just like a physicist would build a theory to explain what happens if you drop an apple, we're going to try and build theories to explain the behavior of people in the economy. So, it's a set of theories or models that tries, I'm going to emphasize the word tries there, tries to explain the behaviors, the decisions of individual economic agents. So, what's an individual economic agent? He's an individual economic agent. So, part of microeconomics would be to explain his behavior. Why is he here? Why is he sitting there? Why is his hat on backwards? Why isn't he smoking a cigar? Why isn't he doing something more fun than sitting here? Right? So we're trying to explain all that kind of crap. What the individual does and what the individual doesn't do. Okay? So the goal is modeling, explaining, and predicting the behavior of individual decision makers. So you're an individual decision maker. We tend to use the word agent as in economic agent. You're an agent, and we're trying to explain your behavior. We're also trying to explain the behavior of other people, other agents. Other kinds of agents are firms. So Google is an agent. So we might be trying to build a model to explain the behavior of a firm. What it produces, what it doesn't produce, how much it produces, what inputs it uses, how its behavior is going to change if, for example, Windows invents some new product. So firms. Another type of economic agent is the government. You know, Obamacare, for example. We try and explain the behavior of the government. Another type of economic agent is a family. How does a family make a decision? How do you decide what to have for dinner or not to have for dinner? How do you decide whether you're going to put grandma in the home or keep her in your home? How does grandma decide whether she wants to stay in your home or go to the home, right? And, you know, we could even talk about other sorts of agents as well, other animals besides humans, your dog, my dog, your cat, trying to explain the behavior of those agents. And one of the things we're going to find is the theories that we're going to lay out to explain the behavior of you aren't going to be that dissimilar than the theories we're going to lay out to explain the behavior of your dog. Then we're going to look at things a little bit more broadly than that. So if we're trying to explain your behavior and we're trying to explain my behavior, but now we have a problem where what you do depends on what I do and what I do depends on what you do, we interact. So how do we figure out collectively what we do as a group? And the group could be very small. In microeconomics, we're typically going to look at small groups. In macroeconomics, we're going to look at large groups. So in macroeconomics, in contrast to microeconomics, we're trying to explain big aggregate things, like how many people in the whole economy are working. In micro, we're more interested in, are you working or not working? Or what determines whether you're working or not working? Or say, what determines whether low-income migrant workers are working or not? Whereas macroeconomics would be more about, what's the unemployment rate? How many people want to be employed but can't be employed? Not how many cigars you consume, but how many cigars everyone consumes, or how many tobacco products everyone consumes. So micro is about explaining on kind of the individual level, individual people, individual products. Macro talks about what's the total value of everything produced in the economy. Will it go up? Will it go down? You know, we're sort of coming out of a recession still. Macro would be about what sort of policies the government might initiate to take us out of the recession. Now, if you went into a psych class or an introductory sociology class, they might describe their goals much the way I just described the goals of microeconomics. The goal of psychology is to explain what? The behavior of individuals. Why they behave the way they behave. You might say psychology is about figuring out ways to make people happier. Well, what's the goal of economics? Trying to figure out ways to make people happier. Now, the thing, though, is maybe their theories about how people operate might be different than our theories about how people operate. You know, one of the things we're going to see a lot when we talk about models is that what a model predicts about behavior depends completely on what you assume. You assume different things, the model predicts different things. Different economic models about the consumer will predict very different things about the consumer's behavior. Psychological models about behavior will predict very different things than economic models about behavior, simply because they're assuming different things about how you work inside your head. Okay? So, but a lot of the goals are pretty much the same. So, as I said, my name is Edward. I'm an environmental economist. When I tell people that, they usually say, well, there isn't such a thing. So the environment is a scarce resource, just like labor and capital and education and all those kind of things. So the question is, how do we want to use scarce environmental resources? How clean do we want the air to be? How much stuff do we want to take out of the environment to produce cars and TV sets? How much do we want to save in its natural form? And then when we get through producing things, we got to get rid of them somewhere. So where do they have to go? They have to go back into the environment. Would we rather have them in the environment as smoke or water pollution? Do we have too much pollution? Do we have too little pollution? Should we save the wilderness? Should we not save the wilderness? Those are the kind of questions that an environmental economist asks. I'm also a statistician. For a long time, I taught statistics to the new PhD students, but luckily for them, I don't do that anymore. And as I get really old now, I'm sort of becoming a moral philosopher. So, web pages for the course. Most of you already know this. I have my own web page for the course. It's not on CU Learn or anything like that. It's just on the web. That's the address. You can see Mori Econ 2010 Home, blah, blah, blah. If you can't find it, you can just Google my name and probably it'll come up near the top of the list. So we have a course webpage that's my personal course page, my personal webpage for the course. But we're also using this software called Applia. And Applia is where you get your online version of the book, and it's where you're going to take all your online quizzes, and all your quizzes are going to be online. So you also have to go to the Applia page and sign up for Applia. What's it cost? $137? Really? Whoa. It used to be cheaper. It used to belong to this econ prof at Stanford. But he got bought out. And about a year after they bought him out, the price went boom. It's still not that bad of a deal, though. So you got to sign up for Applia. That's the Applia address. The way to do it, though, if you haven't done it already, go to the course webpage, and there'll be one of the headings that says signing up for Applia. You go to the Applia page, then there'll be another place you got to click to get the magic number for this course. You click there, it takes you to Applia, you put in the magic number, you pay them the money. Well, I don't think you actually have to pay them until the end of the month, so, or the end of September probably. So, you know, you could check this out and decide the middle of September you can't stand any of this and not have paid any money. I don't know if they're very good about giving you your money back if you pay, though. So you need to sign up for Applia. You're going to have your quizzes on Applia. There's actually a practice quiz that I've got on the schedule for later this week, but actually next week you're going to be taking some quizzes that that are going to count. So we're going to sort of jump into things really quickly. So right now we're not completely full in the course, so we might get some more people. At the moment we've got 6 TAs for the course. We've got 4 graduate TAs. And econ's starting, well, I'm starting, I guess, this new program in the econ department for this course where we actually have some undergraduate TAs now also. So people who are econ majors, who are seniors, they're getting credit to be TAs in this course. A bunch of people sent me applications last spring to do this. I picked 2, so we're going to see how that works. So, no recitations this week. If you already tried to go to one, I'm sorry. I used to make the TAs go to them, but no one would come anyway. And the university has a policy about they don't have them the first week. So, but if you go to the webpage, well, you should also get an email from your TA probably sometime this week. If you have a question or whatever, feel free to this week to email your TA or email them anytime as far as that goes. But they're not holding office hours this week, and they're not holding recitations because no one's going to come. But if you need some help with something, give them a haul. The other thing, though, is if you're sitting next to someone, they probably have already signed up for Applia, so if you can't figure it out, just ask the person next to you. Lots of times people want to talk to me after class. Unfortunately, I have a class right after this class, and so I need to run out the door. But these guys are going to stay around a little bit after class today. And you can also email me.
I just have a quick question. So that means we don't have a required textbook since it's online?
What's the answer to that? Yes, we have a required textbook. It's available to you online. You pay the $137. You have access to it, I think, until December 31st. Then it goes away. Now, what's the textbook? Krugman and Wells, third edition, microeconomics. Paul Krugman, he won a Nobel Prize. He's got a column in the New York Times. Robin Wells is his wife. You can get a hard copy of the book if you want. You could order it through Applia. You could go online just to Google or eBay or whatever. So if you want to have a hard copy of the book, you're free to get one, but I don't require that you have one. My experience is that most people don't have one. But, you know, if you like to save things, so, you know, when you show your grandchildren, you know, this is my textbook when I was back in, you know. It's probably not worth it.
Probably not. No.
It might be worth it, though. I mean, they have me teach this course in the hopes that no one becomes an econ major, right? That I can scare everyone away. But if you were going to become an econ major, there is something to be said for having your basic textbooks. Principles of micro, macro, intermediate micro, intermediate macro. So I've been reading Frankenstein recently, really cool book. But it's got this good line in there about studying. It says, study, so we don't want to study too much. Study had before secluded me from the intercourse of my fellow creatures and rendered me unsocial. So one of the things we're going to learn in this class, you don't want to study what? Too much. You don't want to study too little. You want to study what? Just the right amount, right? So in our case, what we're going to say is you want to study the efficient amount. Now, that doesn't mean you want to study until you get an A, because you might have way better things to do than get an A in this course, right? So you might say, C is good enough. If I study up to this point, I can get a C, and I can do all this other stuff too. The benefits and the costs, right? So you want to study exactly the right amount. Which brings up another issue, the right amount from whose perspective? Your perspective? Now, when he decides how much to study, he's probably going to choose the right amount from what? From my perspective? For him? Or from his perspective? His perspective. Is that the right amount necessarily from his family's perspective? No. Is it necessarily the right amount from society's perspective? No. You know, if he studies a whole bunch, and then he comes in here and asks all these cool questions, and then all the rest of you who are just goofing off and hanging on his coattails, they're going to get all these benefits. But he's not going to take that into account when he decides how much to study. So what might be the right amount of studying for him might not be the right amount of studying from our perspective. Then again, it might. Okay. So, let's start right off. An introduction to explaining behavior. Preferences, constraints, choices, and how economists think. To do well in this course, you have to kind of figure out how economists think. Normal people think economists are kind of weird and think in sort of weird ways. And to do well in this course, you have to figure out how I think. And a lot of economists would say, I think weird, even from an economic perspective. So you got to figure out how I think. And that's kind of the job, well, it's my job, but then those guys who down later translate and say, well, here's what he really means. So we're trying to explain, model, and predict behavior. So let's do a little survey here. Who is in a committed relationship on June 1st? Who was in one on June 1st and isn't in one now? Ah. So what happened? Somehow between then... Do you want to be interviewed about this, sir?
Sure.
Now, when we talk about a relationship and ending a relationship, we can talk about choices. Now, he might be not in a relationship anymore because he chose to not be, or he might not be in the relationship. Why? Somebody else chose that he wasn't going to be in the relationship, right? So, let's see if I can do this. So there was this great article in The Onion a while back. Thousands of high school sweethearts prepare for post-graduation breakup. So what's the topic here? What do you think they're talking about? People's choices. So... anybody here from Kremlin? Cortez? Telluride? Steamboat? You're from Steamboat? Okay. So, how many kids go to Steamboat High?
My graduating class is 146.
146. Okay. And how many kids go to CU?
From my class?
No. Go to CU. 30,000 or something like that?
Yeah.
So what kind of decision did you have to make about your significant other when you left high school and you came to CU?
I didn't have one, so it wasn't that hard.
Another thing we're going to do a lot in this class is let's play Let's Assume, right? So, he was going out with the most beautiful, coolest woman in Steamboat High School. Or guy, maybe. I don't know. We don't want to be prejudicial here, right? So, he was doing the best he could given his constraints. But has anything changed now? Well, he's farther away from all those people, so they're not as physically accessible. You still can text them and Skype them and all that kind of stuff, right? But they're not quite here to touch. But also, maybe there's other alternatives now that you didn't have before, okay? So let's see if I can call up the Onion article here. They come to the rescue, right? Well, anyway, it's just a bunch of stupid stories about how, you know, Becky really loves George. He's the nicest guy. He's got beautiful eyes. They're going on a camping trip in the beginning of July, so she doesn't want to break up with him before the camping trip, but blah, 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 right? She's going to wait because she's going off to Berkeley or something, and she thinks her prospects are going to be better, right? And this other guy is going, well, you know, Wanda was the greatest woman in my high school of 132 people, but now there's 42,000 people at Santa Cruz. Half of them are women, right? He thinks he can do better, right? So the question is, people make choices. They make changes. And how do they decide whether to make the change or not? They look at what? They look at the benefits. They look at the costs, right? Yeah. I think I can manage that. We'll try, though. Or think about your parents, whether your parents are divorced. You know, I have a lot of friends who have switched spouses. It's a choice, maybe. Maybe it's not a choice. Is it a choice? It's sometimes very expensive. Is it worth it? How do you decide? How would an economist look at this kind of question, right? So, changing, being in a different relationship can be a choice. So can staying in the same relationship. You're married now, but you don't get divorced, so you've chosen, in some sense, to stay, right? Now, on the other hand, maybe you stay, but it's not really a choice at all. Maybe your wife has a really big gun, and she's going to shoot you if you leave, right? So then you're not choosing to stay, you're constrained to stay. So one of the things we're going to have to make a big distinction about in this class is the difference between constraints and what you want to do. Sometimes we do things because we're forced to do them, we're constrained to do them. That's not really a choice. But sometimes we get to choose. So the problem with this thing is it's got this stick. Unless this thing can see this stick. So none of you are probably in this situation. I know some people in this situation, though. Let's say you've got a wife, old wife, because you've been married a long time. You're old, too. You got six kids. So do you stay with the wife and six kids, or do you switch to the new wife? Well, if you're old and your wife's old, the new wife's probably going to be old, too. So let's say she has three kids. So that's a question of switching from the new wife with the old wife with six kids to the new wife with a total of nine kids. But the good news is you only get the nine kids, what? Half the time, right? Same thing with, you know, the old boyfriend back in Grand Junction. Do you stay with him or do you take your chances at CU? Now, it used to be a lot harder to maintain two relationships. It used to be you either switch or you don't switch. But now with electronics and stuff, you can do what? You can actually have two relationships going on at the same time. So you can choose to switch, you can not switch, or you can try and play both sides of the field, right? And the new technology has made the cost of doing that lower, but it's also what? It's also made the cost of getting caught at that higher. You know, if we think about sexual relationships, most people choose what? To only be in one sexual relationship at a time. But obviously, at a time, what does that mean? Does that mean for 30 seconds? Or does that mean for 5 years? Or does that mean for the rest of your life? Some people are exclusive because they choose to be exclusive. That's their preference. Some people are exclusive because they're constrained to be exclusive. Maybe they live in a culture, or maybe they belong to a religion where they would just never do anything. It just would go against their culture or go against their religion. That would be a constraint. Now, you might say, well, they could bag their religion or bag their culture, and that sometimes happens, but that's kind of a hard thing to do, at least in the short run. So I looked up some statistics here. So if we look at males between 20 and 24, 14% had no sexual contact with other people in the last 12 months. 55% had one sexual partner, not always, but mostly with a member of the opposite sex. And 33% had two or more partners, and the rest, we don't know about them. So comparing that to females between 20 and 24, the numbers are 12%. So, and the other number for guys was 14%. So, actually, a smaller proportion of women in this age group had no sexual contact than males. But then if we look at the other numbers, what do we see? 59% for the females, that's one sexual partner, where it was 55% for the males. And then when we get to two or more, it's only 21% for the females, but 33% for the males. How is that possible statistically? Is that possible? That males can have more partners than females? I mean, typically, when a male has sex with a female, there's one male and one female, right? Every time a male has sex, a female has sex, right? So why aren't those numbers the same?
I don't know, maybe.
They're lying? That could be. So that raises an interesting question. When we observe the choices that people make, often we don't directly observe their choices. What we do is we ask them what they chose or what they did. And you're suggesting that guys might lie more so than females?
Or the other way around.
Or the other way around, right? So when we try and model and predict choice, we have this distinction between what people actually do, and what we're trying to do is predict what they actually do. And we have to keep in mind when we collect data that what? Sometimes what they say they do is different than what they actually do. But let's pretend for a moment that these are actual numbers. So what we're seeing here is we're seeing some differences between males and females. As an economist, we might ask, why? Constraints? Preferences? Do females have different preferences than males? Are females constrained in different ways than males? Are males constrained in different ways than females? So if we're trying to build an economic model of how much sex someone was having, maybe we'd want to take into account gender, because maybe males and females have different preferences, but also maybe the constraints that you face as a male are different than the constraints you face as a female. You know, you can't do something you can't do. If you're constrained not to do something, you can't do it. Now, if there's two things you can do, you can choose which one to do. I mean, poor people, what? Get to make much fewer choices than rich people. Because they're more what? They're more constrained, right? Okay, some of the costs and benefits of dumping the old one. So let's think about the benefits and costs. And I want us to think about, when we think about the benefits and costs of making a choice, this is a choice that has what? Short-run implications, and it has a choice, and it's a choice that has long-run implications. It's risky. You're not sure how it's going to turn out. So when you dump someone, you're not sure whether you're going to be better off or not. Now, sometimes you know, if it's really bad, you know you're going to be better off, right? At least in the long run. But it's risky. Now, what's one way to reduce the risk? To make sure you have the new one on the line before you dump the old one. Right? So that's a way of reducing the short-run costs of switching from one alternative to another alternative. Okay? I call that monkey barring. You know, when you were a little kid and you went to the playground, they had monkey bars, and what's the rule? You don't let go with one hand until you have your hand on the other monkey bar, right? So now let's think about the benefits of staying with the old one. You know you're going to have a date on Saturday night. They're reliable, etc. There's a certain amount of certainty there, but maybe they're also boring. Maybe they love you, or at least really like you. It's nice to be liked and loved. If you dump them, they probably won't love you anymore, at least not in the long run, right? They've been putting on some weight. They're not as attractive as they used to be, right? They're starting to look and act old. But what causes a lot of these switches is what? People think there might be somebody out there who's better than the one they're with. So they think about what the alternative set looks like. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about the high school thing and graduating from high school. The perception, anyway, is that your choice set has gotten a lot larger. You might be wrong, right?
Yeah.
But at least a lot of people think that, right? So I just tried to come up with some pictures of people here. Good old Taylor. Somebody who used to be socially linked with Taylor. Amanda here. Now this next guy, I just Googled hot young British actors, right? And this is what I got, right? This guy. Does anybody know who he is? Yes? He's kind of cute, I think, right? And then Mr. Combs. So, people think about what their alternatives are. Now, if you think those people are truly in your choice set, like they'd all go out with you, you might behave differently than if you didn't think they were in your choice set. Okay? Now, we're talking about costs and benefits, right? Now, George, we'll just use the name George here. So if you dump George, he might turn into a crazed stalker. He might even shoot himself, right? So that's a potential cost. If your girlfriend is crazy or your boyfriend is crazy, that's going to influence whether you're going to dump them or not, what they might or might not do. Which raises an interesting economic and psychological question. Why is it more likely that George is going to go crazy when he gets dumped than Georgina? You very rarely hear about what? Georgina going crazy and shooting her ex. It happens, but guys do it much more often. So, how would an economist describe all this? Well, we've already gotten to this, but economists believe what? One of the assumptions we tend to make, and psychologists question this assumption, is we assume that people are rational. Rational in the sense that they do the best thing they can do given their constraints. Given their options, the options available to them, They choose the best alternative. And now even an economist would agree that people don't always do that. But when we're trying to build models of behavior, models that explain what people are going to do or what a firm is going to do, we typically assume, and if this is all you remember from an economics, you'll remember a lot, that economic agents, we assume economic agents do the best they can given their constraints. So if you think about a firm, for example, we might say, well, what's the best a firm can do given its constraints? Maximize its profits. And for, if we want to describe consumer theory in a very simple way, we might say that of all the bundles that are in your choice set, you choose the one that's ranked the highest. There's many bundles of goods in the world you can't afford. But of all the ones you can afford, we're simply going to assume you choose the one that you think is best. Now, it used to be that economists were only concerned with things like whether you buy a washing machine or not, or you get a house with 5 bedrooms versus 4 bedrooms. But for the last, I don't know, 30, 40 years at least, economists have really gotten into a lot of other things. You know, we talk now about relationships, we talk about sex, we talk about work, leisure, happiness, all kinds of stuff, drug use, you name it. So anyway, one thing you might want to keep in mind, though, is when we assume in this class that you do the best you can given your constraints, in psych class, they might not be assuming that. So one question is, do people really do the best they can, given their constraints? That's one question we need to ask. Another question, though, is if you have one theory, and one theory assumes people do the best they can, given their constraints, and another theory doesn't assume that, then the two theories are going to predict very different things about how people behave. Back up. Short-run costs, screaming, fighting, phone calls, etc., etc. Now, one of the long-run costs of dumping your significant other is you might be alone for the rest of your life. You might think that's unlikely, but somewhere in the back of your head, you're thinking, maybe no one ever again will like me or go out with me. So, long-run cost, you might be alone. Sometimes it's very costly to switch in terms of money. If you get divorced, a large part of your wealth goes to who, typically? Lawyers, right? Now, on the other hand, there might be great long-term benefits. You know, you're kind of bored with the current one, et cetera, but, you know, maybe if you switch, you're going to have love, excitement, and great sex for 100 years. Maybe not, too, but maybe, right? So you look at the benefits, you look at the costs, but part of the problem is you're not sure what the benefits and costs are, so what you're doing is guesstimating. What do I think the benefits are going to be? What's the probability? So I was reading the New York Times. I only get this stuff from the New York Times, of course. So we've cut off her face a little bit. The guy in the middle is Peter Brandt, recently worth $1 billion. Newspaper business, actually the paper, right? Owned hundreds of Andy Warhols, had his own polo team, super, super rich guy. So who's the woman on the left and right? His wife, right? She's a former Victoria's Secret model. And at least in August 20th, 2010, they were getting divorced, right? So just a little bit about this divorce. She filed for divorce to end their 15-year marriage. She said he was too controlling. He said she abused drugs, alcohol, and cheated. Okay? They're both in court on this particular day for mandatory drug testing. They've already spent millions and millions of dollars on their divorce. The kids are going crazy. What was it, 12,000 pages of public documents have been filed for one divorce. So just think about the problem here. Let's say it's all true. Let's say he's controlling, she's using drugs, cheating. So now they're getting divorced. Should they get divorced? Shouldn't they get divorced? Is this a rational decision on their part? Is it a rational thing? Not a rational thing. They're going on, they're fighting about all kinds of stuff. He said, she said. Now, he lost a bunch of money in the time. They have three kids, by the way, some of which are fairly old. They've been married for quite a while. Come on. He didn't have a prenup, which makes the divorce a lot more what? Contentious, costly, etc., particularly from his perspective. Their good friend Donald Trump, he was on the news this morning, if you were watching the news, he said, bad idea. If you're going to get married, have a prenup, right? What's the problem with a prenup, though? Pardon? Nothing's wrong with a prenup? Why wouldn't you have a prenup? Yeah, it's kind of saying you're already planning for the exit, right? Like you're really not committed to this relationship. So if we were getting married and you said to me, I want a prenup, I'd go, oh dear, you know, that means you really don't love me, you don't think we're going to be together for long, etc., etc. And it makes it more likely the relationship's not going to go well, probably. But at the same time, well, you think it could go the other way, too? If both people want a prenup, is that usually the case, though? I mean, when do you get a prenup? Usually when one person has a lot more of what than the other? Money, right? And then usually the person with the money wants the prenup, right? Their life was relatively pleasant. They have two sons, Peter 16, Harry 14, and a daughter, Lily. They would spend Sunday afternoons watching Mr. Brandt and his polo team play in the grassy field across the street from their estate, White Birch Farm, right? Now it's all falling apart. Now we're into, she says, he stole 44 Warhol paintings from the house, right? He says, she took this, she took that, blah, blah, blah. They're in court. They're testifying about who's faithful, who's unfaithful, a big, gigantic fight. So we're going through all this because is this rational behavior? Is it irrational behavior? Are they behaving in a way that makes sense from an economic point of view? Or are they just whacked out crazy, kind of? I don't know. Something to think about. You'll be happy to know, though, what? They have reconciled. They're living in separate houses, but they called off the divorce. Why? Probably because it was too damn expensive. You know, they probably just decided, well, why don't you live here? I'll live there. You do what you want. I'll do what I want. But let's not give all our money to lawyers. So, if you get divorced, and most of you will, no, not you, right? Everyone else, but not you, right? So, most of you will get divorced. Does that mean getting married was a mistake? If you get divorced, does that mean it was a bad decision, a bad choice to get married in the first place? At the time, it was the right thing to do. Now, when you get married, see, this is how weird economists are. The way an economist might think about it is, at that moment in time, the right thing to do The best thing to do is to get married. But when you get married, does that mean you chose to stay married for the rest of your life? So another question is, what's the optimal time to get divorced? Like if your grandparents have been married 50 years or something, they haven't reached that point yet, right? And quite a few people die before they reach that point, right? Now imagine though that you live for 10,000 years. Imagine if you live for 10,000 years, everybody would get divorced, right? So you might think of it as you make these separate sequential choices. You can't get divorced until you're what? Married, right? So marriage is a requirement to be able to get divorced. But then once you're married, divorce is on the table. So do you stay married another week, another month, 5 more years? What's the optimal time to split, right? Let's go back to the uncertainty issue. How people feel about uncertainty. So we're talking about whenever you make a choice, you know, you buy the ab machine at 3 o'clock in the morning while you're watching TV because you think it's going to give you six-pack abs, right? But there's some uncertainty about whether it's really going to work or not work. So there's when you buy stuff or you choose to do stuff, there is uncertainty, right? Some people like uncertainty, and some people like certainty. So when we think about predicting your behavior, one thing that might be an important determinant of your behavior is how you feel about risk and uncertainty. So that's going to be an important thing. Another important thing is how you trade off current benefits versus future benefits and costs. That's called discounting. So imagine two extremes. Imagine at one extreme a person who truly only lives for the moment. So what they do is they try and make this moment as good as possible, no matter what the cost is for the future. That would be a person with a very high discount rate. They completely discount the future. At the other extreme, you might think about someone who puts a great deal of weight on what's going to happen in the future versus the present. And different people discount the future at different rates. Some people are very much into right this moment. If you were really right into this moment right now, would you be here? She's saying, you're going to say yes? If for the next 30 seconds this was the best thing you could imagine doing in your whole life, listening to me drone on and on, then even if you had a high discount rate, you would be here. Because it was the most pleasurable thing you could do, right? Now she's shaking her head saying, no, that's not true, right? So the fact that she's here probably means she's what? Investing somewhat in the future. She's worried somewhat about the future, so she's putting a certain amount of weight on the future. So when you make a decision like whether to get divorced or whether to split or not, a big issue is how much weight you put on the present versus how much weight you put on the future. A lot of times, the short-run costs of breaking up can be very high. And the benefits don't come until the long run. So you might be in a fairly unhappy relationship, but if you discount the future at a fairly high rate, on a day-by-day basis, the best thing for you to do is to stay and avoid the big blow-up. Because you're not putting much weight on the benefit you're going to get a year down the line, 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line. On the other hand, if you put more weight on the future, you're going to be more willing to put up with the short-run upset. So think about cigarettes. And let's think about cigarettes from an economic point of view. It's pretty costly. If you smoke a lot, it's pretty costly in the short run to quit smoking. So let's say you're somebody who enjoys smoking, but you also know it's going to kill you. So in the long run, it's going to be a bad thing. Are you making a good choice if you continue smoking? It depends on how you weight the future versus the present. If you put a lot of weight on the present versus the future, so you're counting the present heavily and the future where you're going to die of cancer, what's the opposite of heavily? Lightly, right? You might, on a day by every day, it makes sense to keep smoking. The rational thing is to keep going, and that's what a lot of people do. Now, on the other hand, if you don't put more weight on the future, you don't discount the future very much, then it makes more sense to quit because the benefits are going to come in the future and they're important to you now. But if all you care about is right now and you enjoy the nicotine buzz, then by all means, keep smoking. Even though you know in the long run it's not good for you. But if you don't care much about the long run, then it's the right thing to do. And every moment by moment is the short run. So I don't care about the future, so I have another cigarette. 5 minutes from now, I'm in the present. I care more about the present than the future. I have another cigarette. Another place you see this, besides relationships and smoking, is, let's call it sort of persistent nagging injuries. Like as you get older, most of you, after you get divorced, you're going to have bad backs, right? Most old people have bad backs. Now, if you're out there on your motorcycle, your Ducati or something, your new Ducati, and you break your back, what do? You go to the hospital and you get it fixed. You have to go to the hospital and get it fixed. You're in all this incredible pain. You go to the hospital, you get the surgery, you stay in the hospital, you do the rehabilitation. But what if your knee just sort of hurts a little bit? Hurts every day, but only a little bit. On a day-by-day basis, you say, shit, do I want to go to the hospital and get surgery and be in pain for the next week and blah, blah, blah? No, I'd rather put up with the knee pain for one more day. But then tomorrow you make the same decision, the same decision, and the same decision. So one of the things this predicts is that people tend to do what? They might suffer for their whole lives, but if the suffering's at a low level, they probably won't do much in the short run to offset that suffering. But again, that depends on how they feel about the present versus the future. We talked about perceptions. It's not what's going to happen, but your perception of what's going to happen, right? Some cute guy smiles at you. Maybe they're just somebody who smiles a lot. But you think it means more than, so you dump the wife, right? Or the boyfriend, because this other person smiled at you. Or somehow you think that sex with the new wife in the backseat of the new car is going to be way better than sex with the old wife in the backseat of the old car. Again, it's a perception. It might be what? It might be correct. It might not be correct. If we go over to the psych department, they'll tell you that people always make misperceptions about good and bad things in the future. They would tell us that we overpredict the good things. Like something happens, we say, oh, that's going to make us really happy. But then we also think it's going to make us really happy for a really long time. And we tend to make that mistake. Usually it doesn't make us happy for a really long time, just a short time. And on the other side of the coin, there's lots of studies that show, for example, you know, if somebody came to you and said, we won't pick on you. We'll pick on you. Somebody comes to you and says, oh, you have this terrible cancer. Right? You're going to be really sick and it's going to be really gruesome. Right? Now, we would expect that to make him what? Happy or unhappy? Unhappy. He would also probably do what? Probably assume that it's going to make him unhappy for a really long time. Assuming you stay alive. Right? But a lot of research shows that 2 years later, even if he's still got the cancer, he'll probably be just as happy as he was before the diagnosis. But we mispredict. We assume the bad stuff's going to be bad for longer, and the good stuff's going to be good for longer. That's a problem that economists have. Now, economists do everything for money, right? So why don't we do something for money here? So if you have a significant other right now, would you dump them right now for $1 million? See, here's the problem. We're going to have to enter into some sort of contract that makes it impossible for you to get back together with them, right? I don't want to give you $1 million for dumping somebody if you're going to be back together with them in a few days, right? So let's play let's pretend. You'd do it for $1 million?
I'd probably do it for $1 million.
$1 million. Would you do it for a dollar?
Not for a dollar.
Are you volunteering over there, or are you just stretching? Who wants to text their significant other right now and dump them?
Do it.
Who wants to do it for a penny? Anybody takers? He said he'd do it for $1 million.
Yeah, $1 million?
Maybe. $1?
Will you actually give me $1 right now?
Let's see if I have $1, okay? Yeah, I got $1. Wait a sec, how do we know?
You can check my phone.
Yeah, I'll check it.
Call.
I figured I was going to have to go at least till $5, right?
Must need the money.
What?
It's not going to work out anymore. We need to break up. That's what he said.
You can send it.
I guess I have to give him $1 now, right? I don't think he's serious, but I'll give him $1. Now, under what circumstance would you do it for $1? I did this once for pets. I said, okay, how much money do I have to give you to kill your pet, right? And I get to like $5 and some guy puts his hand up, right? But then he explains, you know, the cat's like 18 years old, has cancer, is blind, and he was going to put the cat to sleep that afternoon anyway. So in that case, you know, makes sense. Were you going to put her to sleep or anything? Later this out, now he's texting back saying, just joking, I did it for money.
Hi, Dad. Hi, Dad.
Yeah, you see, the problem is the contracts, but what time is it?
12:02.
I've just got some statistics here. I wanted to talk a little bit about constraints, and the point is, it's just statistics about how many times people have been married or not married as a function of their gender and their age. So you might say, could Edward have chosen to be married at this point in his life 3 times? And the answer to that is probably yes, right? Could you? Could you be married 3 times by now? It'd be hard, right? If we look at the statistics, there are a couple people in the 20 to 24-year age group that have been married to 3 times. It's possible, I guess, but most people are constrained not to be able to do that. A lot of times, our relationships, as I said earlier, are constrained by the society we live in. What's acceptable, what's not acceptable, right? Let's talk about constraints. Not everyone is in your choice set. There's some people that would go out with you. There's some people that wouldn't. The ones that would be in a relationship with you are in your choice set, but the ones who aren't, you're constrained not to be in a relationship with them. So think about me. So I'm not rich, overweight, old. I go to bed at 9 o'clock. My choice set is what? My choice set is limited. I don't know quite how I came up with this list, but I decided that all these people are not in my choice set. They wouldn't go out with me. Taylor Swift, my good friend Lindsay Lohan, George Bush, and George Clooney. Okay? I'm not constrained to be in a relationship with any of them. What I want you to make a separation in your mind right now is the difference between a constraint and a preference. To say they're not in my choice set doesn't tell us anything about whether I'd like to go out with them or not. It just says it's not on the table. Okay. Now, let's go back to Frankenstein here. Frankenstein was actually the doctor, and he created this monster. And what created the whole problem in this book is the monster started off, the one that Dr. Frankenstein created, as a really nice guy. The book's not at all like the movies. So, the monster wasn't really a monster at all. He was a really nice guy, except he was what? Really, really ugly. So anytime anyone saw him, they would run in the opposite direction. So his problem was there was no one in his choice set. His choice set was empty. So he went to Dr. Frankenstein, the guy who created him, and said, please, please make a really ugly woman that'll go out with me. So ugly she won't think I'm ugly. And Dr. Frankenstein wouldn't do it, so the big ugly guy got mad and started running around killing people. You can hardly blame him, right? So let's do a little algebra here let's think about another constraint. I don't know if you guys have heard of this constraint. Let's call this the dating rule constraint. You can't date anyone who's less than half your age plus 7. So if you're 10 years old, does it work if you're 10 years old? 5 plus 7 is 12. You'd have to date somebody who's at least 12. I guess it doesn't work too well if you're 5. What if you're 100? They got to be 57, right? What if you're 20? Got to be 17. Okay, my daughter's 17, so how young can she go in terms of boys? Half of 17, what's that?
15 and a half.
15 and a half. So she'd be robbing the cradle if they weren't at least 15 and a half, right? So if you're 40, they better be at least what? The rule works pretty well, actually. They got to be at least 27, right? So that would be, if you lived by that rule, that would be an example of a constraint, and that would limit who you could go out with. Okay? So what constrains our choices? Not just in terms of dating or relationship, but all our choices. Why do some people have more choices, more opportunities than other people? And would you rather have more opportunities or less? Well, how much money you have is really important. You can't buy stuff unless you have money. Rich people can buy a lot of things, can afford a lot of bundles that poor people can't afford. Now, do you think, oh, what's her name back there? What was her name? Stephanie or Seymour? Yes, Stephanie, who married the short little guy who's in the paper business who had $1 billion, right? Do you think that had anything to do with money? If he had been really poor, do you think she would have married him? Probably not. Maybe, but probably not, right? We're also constrained by our time. In fact, time is one of our ultimate constraints. The hour you wasted in here, right, is gone. It's never coming back. If you spend an hour doing one thing, you can't spend that hour doing something else. You can't be in two places at the same time. We try, but it's hard. We're constrained by our abilities. Some of us have many more abilities than others. Some of us are good at some things and not good at others. Maybe she's good at some things that I'm really bad at, and maybe I'm good at some things that she's really bad at. Some poor people are just what? Bad at everything, right? That's a big constraint. You're constrained by your looks. Do you think the rich guy would have married the Victoria's Secret model if she was really ugly? Probably not, right? So we're constrained by our looks. Another important constraint is what? The norms of society. what's acceptable in your society versus what's acceptable in other societies. We tend not to break the implicit rules of our society. And what those rules are vary a lot. You know, if we lived in a very fundamentalistic Muslim culture, for example, our cultural constraints would be very different than they are here. If you lived in Mississippi, in some tiny little town, the cultural constraints might be very different than what they are in Boulder. You know, think about something like homosexuality, right? And where it's accepted and where it's not accepted. Those are constraints. We're also constrained by the law. Yeah, you could break the law, but to a large extent, we are constrained by the law. So when we're trying to predict your behavior, and we talk about what you choose, before we ask which one you're going to choose, we ask which ones do you get to choose between. And all these things influence which ones you get to choose between. The more resource-rich you are, rich people, in all these different ways, have a much bigger choice set than poor people in all these different ways. And the final one we have to keep in mind is that our choices are very much constrained by what other people want and don't want. What you can do and can't do is affected by other people. You shouldn't have sex with people who don't want to have sex with you. That's a constraint. Now, not everybody lives by that constraint, but you can get in a lot of trouble if you don't live by that constraint. You know, I want to buy another house. I already own two houses. I can't afford to buy another house. It's a constraint. What are constraints caused by? Constraints are caused by scarcity. For example, we talked about time being a constraint. Why is it a constraint? You've only got so much of it. It's what? It's scarce, right? But think about my friend George again. He wants to get married. He's heterosexual. He wants to have kids. He doesn't want to adopt, okay? The last one's important. He recently took a job teaching. They're sitting there going, which grad student is he talking about, right? He recently took a job teaching in a small college in rural Kansas. Most of the students are undergraduates. He's about 40. So think about it. If he's about 40, half of 40 plus 7 is 27. Most of the undergraduates are too young, right? Now, remember, he wants to have kids. He doesn't want to adopt. That means he's got to have a kid with someone who's capable of having a kid. Fertility starts going downhill, you know, around 35, starts dropping faster around 38 for women. So what does he have to do? He's got to find somebody who lives in this small rural Kansas community or is willing to move there that's between the ages of 27 and 38. He's constrained, right? If you're interested, send me an email. I can forward it to him, you know. I'm just joking. Economics is all about scarcity, and scarcity is what forces us into making choices. Because things are scarce, we can't have everything we want. Because we can't have everything we want, we make choices. What we're going to do in this course is we're going to try and build models to explain the choices that people make. So hopefully some of you will come back on Thursday.